Are those the tule elk out there?
Oh, wow. There they are.
Got to see some.
I don't think we should go any closer, really.
No. No, we should stay right here.
I'm standing on a grassy bluff at Tamales Point in Point Reyes National Seashore. It's a sunny July day, and I can see the waves of the Pacific Ocean from where I'm standing. I'm at the northernmost edge of Point Reyes, which is a triangular-shaped peninsula that juts out from the northern coast of California, about 40 miles north of San Francisco. It's run by the National Park Service. This is one of the most popular tourist destinations in the area. Winding roads, dramatic sweeping beaches, and wild animals like elephant seals, bobcats, and the famous tule elk. Today, I'm here with investigative journalist Peter Byrne and Teresa Harlan, an indigenous woman adopted by a Coast Miwok family, who are descended from the original inhabitants of this land. And we've just spotted a herd of tule elk. I'm watching the fog roll gently across the landscape, and there are these rolling hills dotted with wildflowers and different types of grasses and brush, and 12 elk in the distance grazing. And right beyond them is the Pacific Ocean. If you've never seen them before, tule elk are majestic. They're tall and slender, with tawny brown fur and a big ruff of darker brown fur on their chest. The males can have antlers that can grow up to 4 feet tall. Tule elk are a federally protected species. They were at the brink of extinction by the end of the 19th century, but were reintroduced here at Tamales Point, which the state of California declared an elk preserve in 1970. But the elk here today aren't free to roam like their ancestors did.
These are the 8-foot tall elk fences.
Oh, wow.
Teresa and Peter have brought me to the edge of the elk preserve, which is separated by a fence.
Can you describe this fence for me?
It's a wire, metal fence that's 8 feet tall on big posts.
And does it run the whole width of the peninsula?
3 miles across from the bay to the ocean, yes. Can't get around it.
The fence cuts the tip of Tamales Point off completely from the rest of Point Reyes.
And the only passage through is this?
Cattle guards.
Cattle guards. And they're designed in a specific way, right?
Yeah, the cows and elk can't cross them, otherwise they'll break their legs.
The fence bisects the peninsula without any gaps other than the cattle grate, which allows cars to drive through. There are tule elk in other places at Point Reyes, but one of the biggest populations lives here. The elk preserve is about 4% of the nearly 70,000 total acres in Point Reyes National Seashore. From the 10 elk that the state reintroduced to Tamales Point, the herd has grown to hundreds. But now, the tule elk in the preserve are dying of thirst and starvation. Skylar Thomas has seen this firsthand. He's a filmmaker and blogger who's very outspoken on the subject. And what Skylar's documented on his blog is disturbing. He posted an especially dire photo of an elk that was completely emaciated. He captioned it, "Dead elk walking." Here's Skylar.
Well, you can see the shoulder blades and the outline of the hip bone. You can even see, you know, the femur, the leg bones in the front, and pretty much all the ribs. But in addition to that, and if you zoom in on this, like I can see it better at home, you can even see outlines of the spinal column along the top.
This photo was taken at a place called North Pond 2, one of only two ponds inside the fence at Tamales Point.
And it's definitely the only body of water this year remaining. And I say body of water rather generously because it's, you know, just like some putrid, filthy water that's on its way to being caked mud.
Skylar's other photos show rotting elk carcasses decomposing in the mud, shallow ponds drying into cracked dirt, and diseased elk with black matted fur. In March 2021, the National Park Service announced that over 150 of the Tamales Point elk herd died in the previous year alone. That's more than a third of the total herd.
So when you're out there documenting these elk, I mean, what's going through your mind when you see them looking like this?
I think about how disconnected most people are and how easy it is to just say, well, it's nature, it's natural, or they'll be fine, or they'll figure it out, instead of putting yourself in the position of a creature that has no fighting chance to improve its situation. You know, that's not nature. You know, if we don't even give them a fighting chance, they can't leave because of the fence.
Skyler cares a lot about the elk, so much that he's part of a lawsuit filed by the Harvard Animal Law and Policy Clinic against the National Park Service over its treatment of the tule elk. Recent necropsies of a group of dead elk found that they likely died of starvation. Even more troubling, some of the elk had ingested poisonous plants like hemlock and lupine, which elk will only do if they're very desperate for food. While the populations of elk in other parts of the park are holding steady, or even increasing, the elk behind the fence at Tamales Point are, quote, dying at a dramatic rate. Those are the words of a veterinarian who testified in the lawsuit. Here's what else she told the court, quote, dying by starvation and dehydration is inhumane. I can think of no worse way for an animal to die. According to the plaintiffs, the Park Service denied there wasn't enough food or water for the elk. A National Park Service spokesperson declined to speak to me about the tule elk at Tamales Point, citing the pending litigation. Animal rights activists are calling for this fence at Tamales Point to be torn down. But why is this fence here in the first place? Why does it cut off the tule elk herd at Tamales Point from the rest of the peninsula? And why did the National Park Service build it? The answer lies with another four-legged animal on this peninsula. The cows. At any given time, there's several thousand of them roaming the pastures across Point Reyes. They're here to supply the 24 beef and dairy ranches that operate in the national park. The land is owned by the federal government, and the Park Service issues reservations or special use permits to the ranchers. About a quarter of the park is used for active ranching. The fence effectively separates the tule elk from competing with the cows for food and water. And as a result, it benefits the ranching operations in the park. You might be surprised to hear there's cattle ranching happening in a national park. It's a complicated arrangement, and not a very common one. Point Reyes is one of just a handful of national parks that allow for-profit cattle ranching on their land. For many, the cows are part of the popular imagination of Point Reyes and the county of Marin, where it's located. If you're familiar with this part of Northern California, you know it's home to a number of respected brands like Strauss Family Creamery or Clover Sonoma, brands that use dairy sourced from ranches in Point Reyes, brands that Bay Area residents recognize at the supermarket, brands that sell products labeled local, organic, and sustainable.
Minimally processed, always organic, never ultra-pasteurized, and forever committed to sustaining family farms. Taste the Strauss difference. Your purchase helps further our mission.
But some environmentalists are trying to raise awareness that, unfortunately, even the most local and organic beef and dairy products, and even those from idyllic Point Reyes, come at a steep environmental cost. I wanted to see the environmental impact firsthand, so I drove to Point Reyes to meet Chance Cutrano. He's the director of programs for the Resource Renewal Institute, which actually sued the National Park Service in 2016 over its ranch management. We meet up at Abbott's Lagoon, a popular hiking spot.
So should we take a walk?
Sure.
Let's do it.
Okay. We'll walk this way.
And now we've crossed a little bridge over a creek, and now we are, where are we now? Describe what we're seeing.
We are in the heart of the lagoon. This is prime otter habitat. This is prime heron and egret habitat. Looking straight ahead of me, you're seeing this dune ecosystem that right over the hill, there's gonna be endangered snowy plover habitat. This is a critical intertidal wetland ecosystem right here.
The view is breathtaking. A small creek opens into an expansive lagoon encircled by sand dunes. Tufts of grass grow along the shore and water birds circle overhead.
Abbott's Lagoon is one of the main water features of Point Reyes National Seashore. It's one of the most biodiverse areas of the National Seashore. You have sand dunes, you have this incredible shrubland, you have these upland hilly areas as well. And it's also where we butt up against a lot of silage mowing for cattle, as well as a lot of manure spreading from dairy and beef operations at the seashore.
Silage mowing means mowing for grasses and other plants to be fed to cows. And the other thing Chance mentions is the cow manure.
And lots of cow manure. Over 100 million pounds of cow manure.
All that manure has to go somewhere. And sometimes it drains from the nearby dairy ranches into the waterways, like Abbott's Lagoon. This can cause algae blooms, which poison animals, like endangered coho salmon.
Almost without fail, every year, you get a perfect example of what an overload of nitrogen and phosphorus looks like, with these glowing rings of green, alien green, right around the edges of all of our waterways.
To the casual observer, these landscapes can seem natural, wild, and healthy. But under the surface, they can be horribly out of balance.
These dairies that are placed at this northern end of the seashore are also known to be contributors to some of the worst water pollution in the National Seashore, which is also some of the worst water pollution in the state of California, wow, in our national park.
Park Service spokesperson Melanie Gunn said manure is only allowed to be sprayed in designated areas away from sensitive environmental resources and on flat ground where it can't seep into the waterways. According to Chance, the problem isn't just what ranches are putting into the water. It's also how much water they're removing from the ecosystem. We continue walking until we see a collection of ranch buildings on a nearby hilltop. This is McClure's Dairy, also known as I Ranch. The ranches here on Point Reyes are designated alphabetically, A through Z. McClure's produces dairy products for Clover Sonoma, or at least they used to.
McClure's Dairy just announced that they're actually shutting down their dairy operation, the oldest and largest dairy at Point Reyes National Seashore, because they've run out of water. Their aquifers are dry.
I tried to get in touch with ranch owner Bob McClure for this story, but was unable to reach him in time for broadcast. He's mentioned publicly that the drought was one of the biggest factors that played into his decision. Melanie from the Park Service agrees that the drought is having a major impact on the ranches.
You know, I think that you're right. The dairies are under the most amount of pressure because of the water and because this drought that we're in right now is unprecedented. The worst in Marin County for over 140 years. This is significant. Bob McClure said, you know what? I've never seen it like this. I don't have enough water to operate. I'm not going to do dairy ranching anymore. He made that decision to step back. There may be similar decisions of other dairies in the future.
Ranching is a notoriously water-intensive industry, and McClure's Dairy isn't the only one that's run out of water. Nearby J Ranch received emergency permits to pump water from a wetland area called Kehoe Creek after their aquifers gave out too. According to National Park Service documents, J Ranch needs between 10,000 and 15,000 gallons a day. Just cleaning a barn uses 1,000 gallons per day, and that's after taking measures to conserve water. The National Park Service later revoked that emergency permit to pump from the wetland after the drought intensified.
Your organization actually crunched the numbers on that, right?
We did. So for water alone, we're looking at, you know, over 120 million gallons of water consumed by the cattle out here.
And that's just in 1 year. All of that water is being used for cattle while California is seeing severe multi-year droughts. And as tule elk on the other side of the fence are dying from lack of food and water. But Ted McIsaac would disagree with that. He's one of the few ranchers willing to talk to me for this story. The ranch he operates today is located in the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, a section of land outside the park but managed by the National Park Service.
What's your take on the tule elk situation?
They pretty much let the elk manage themselves. But they're in a fixed area, and there's, you know, it's got a carrying capacity of so many animals, and when the animals overpopulate, they'll revert backwards a little bit, you know, like maybe lack of forage. I don't, even today with the drought, I don't, you know, people are blaming they're out of water. Well, I don't, I don't believe they're out of water. You know, there's still water out there in that point all over the place.
You don't think there's not enough drinking water for them?
No, I think there's plenty of water out there. You know, I know the family that ran cows out there, you know, before the elk came, and they never had a problem with water. And when you let a herd, you know, roam, range freely, you're going to have a fluctuation in the population. If you don't fluctuate your herd numbers, you know, on your own, Mother Nature's going to take care of it. And when they see a die-off and everybody gets worried, that we're starving them to death, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying that for the elk, it's almost like this is the natural condition for the elk, and when they become overpopulated, they'll die off on their own?
Yeah, yeah.
When Point Reyes National Seashore was created, its stated purpose was to preserve the wilderness and wildlife like the Tule elk. But it also was created to protect the cultural heritage of the ranchers. And these are proving difficult goals to reconcile. There are opposing views and claims not only on how the park should be managed today, but on how and why the park was created in the first place. Remember when I told you Chance's organization, the Resource Renewal Institute, is suing the National Park Service? That forced the agency to review its general management plan and assess whether to get rid of cattle ranching completely or to allow even more commercial activities to take place.
This is kind of the first time that the National Park Service has looked at all the ranching lands comprehensively, which is a really big deal.
The last time the National Park Service updated their general management plan was in 1983. This time around, they found that 2,000 acres of the most sensitive park areas were in zones used for active ranching. So they rezoned them for protection. You might be wondering why the National Park Service has to walk this tightrope between wilderness management and commercial ranching. Again, this type of arrangement is unusual for a national park. To better understand the situation, we have to take a step back in history. Ranching on Point Reyes was established well before the creation of the national park. Again, here's rancher Ted McIsaac.
My family settled here in 1866.
1866, wow, that was a long time ago, huh? A
couple years ago, yeah.
Point Reyes National Seashore was established by Congress in 1962, nearly a century after Ted's family started ranching. And the park could only be created if the ranchers chose to sell their land to the government.
Well, you know, it's almost 50 years ago since the park was developed. And back then when they wanted to convert it into a park, the ranchers were not really favorable for it, but they sat down and made an agreement with the government that if we sell our land to the government, we want the right to be able to continue ranching on our own ranches. Basically, that's how it got done.
Congress purchased all the lands and waters in Point Reyes from private owners for $57 million. Later on, the National Park acquired more land to form the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, including the McIsaac Ranch, in 1983. And how much did the park pay for your land?
It was about $2 million.
Oh, wow. So that's a good chunk of money.
Yeah.
$2 million in 1983 is the equivalent of about $5.5 million today. Other ranchers received similar buyouts. For instance, McClure's, the ranch that just closed down this year, sold for $1.3 million in 1971. Today, Ted McIsaac and his family continue to raise beef cattle on their ranch, and they pay a fee to the National Park Service to use the land. He wouldn't tell me exactly how much, but said that it's less than market rate rent. Ted says his operation today runs pretty slim. He has a permit to run 190 cattle, but is currently only keeping 140 because of the drought. He says it's a small family operation.
The biggest challenge is, I guess you could say, financial. You know, we're all basically small operations relative to the cattle industry. Every member of my family, including myself, over the years, all have or had full-time jobs besides working the ranch. You know, it's just the ranch won't carry itself, basically. It's very slim if it does.
So this is not a super profitable business, huh?
No, it is not. But, you know, it's a kind of a false sense that the ranchers, if you have a big ranch, you're making big money, but that's certainly not the case. You know, when we're running 120 or 40 right now, even when we're running at full capacity, it's still tough. And to have a ranch operation that's going to carry you, you're going to have to be up in the 600-700 numbers or better.
If you ask the ranchers, they say they sold their land to the park with the caveat that the Park Service would let them continue ranching. But if you talk to the environmentalists, they ask, why should the ranchers be allowed to stay when they received million-dollar buyouts for their land? Simply put, the land means different things to different people. But there's only so much of it to go around. And it'll take more than a fence to keep the peace. There's been a lot of recent articles written about the Tule Elk and ranching at Point Reyes. But there's a whole part of the story that isn't often mentioned in media narratives. I'm talking about the original inhabitants of this land and their descendants, who are still here. Before ranching arrived, Point Reyes was an intricate coastal prairie and was home to the Coast Miwok peoples, who lived on this land for thousands of years before the arrival of the first Europeans. They called this peninsula Tamalhuye. They lived sustainably and actively tended the land, cultivating edible plants and managing intentional burns. They harvested clams and abalone from Tamales Bay and hunted mule deer and tule elk. Old-growth grasses like fescue and dry oat and wildflowers would have covered the landscape in a spongy layer of plants, so thick you couldn't see the soil underneath. To find out more about the indigenous history of this land, I called up a member of the Coast Miwok Tribal Council of Marin, which is not a federally recognized tribe, but includes the most likely descendants of the original inhabitants of Point Reyes.
Opentoish, good morning. My name is Joseph Sanchez. I'm a Coast Miwok descendant from a separate band called the Kukuipo. That's basically from the Nicasio area. My family actually resided in Tamales Bay. That was a large village of Coast Miwok Indians right there at Marshall Marconi area, the east shore of Tamales Bay. And we were there for thousands and thousands of years.
That is, until the Europeans arrived. The Spanish landed in California in the 1500s, but reportedly it was English colonizer and privateer Sir Francis Drake and his crew who were the first Europeans to meet the Coast Miwok peoples. His crew included a chaplain named Francis Fletcher, who kept notes of the encounter.
On the voyage of Francis Drake in June 26, 1579, he said, quote, "They are a people, the Coast Miwok, of a tractable, free, and loving nature, without guile or treachery. The men commonly so strong of body that which two or three of our men could hardly bear, one of them would take upon his back, and without grudging, carrying it easily away, uphill and downhill, an English mile." What got me, though, in that quote was the word tractable. Well, what does the word tractable mean? It means capable of being easily trained or managed, very amenable to discipline, docile, governable, pliable. And this is from a chaplain, supposedly a religious man, on a slave ship circumnavigating the world looking for gold, spices, and slaves.
Drake was a slave trader and participated in some of the earliest English slaver voyages to Africa. Fast forwarding to the mid-1700s, Spanish colonizers created the mission system, a series of outposts across the coast of California, including Mission San Rafael in Marin. The native peoples of California, including the Coast Miwok, were forced to assimilate and coerced into slave labor for the missions. Spanish missionaries aimed to stamp out indigenous culture and history. The missionaries saw them as less than human. Joe Sanchez reads me a passage from the book A Cross of Thorns by historian Elias Castillo, writing about Junipero Serra, the priest who was in charge of the missions at that time.
Serra wrote, quote, "In the midst of all our little troubles, the spiritual side of the missions is developing most happily. In Mission San Antonio, there are simultaneously two harvests at one time, one for wheat and of a plague among the children who are dying." Now that says a lot to me.
Whoa, wait, so just a pause there. There's two harvests, one for wheat and one of a plague. Why would he call that a harvest?
Because they were baptized and those children are going to heaven.
Whoa.
Very dark. But that's Sarah, who is a saint.
Infant deaths were extremely common at the missions. In fact, the population of native peoples living in the missions declined from 87,000 to 4,000 in just over 30 years. That's according to research that cited the missionaries' own reports. meaning the actual numbers could be much higher. Thousands of those who died were Coast Miwok. Sarah was declared a saint by the Catholic Church in 2015. Yet, during his life, he actively encouraged the brutalization and dehumanization of the native peoples in California. Statues of him were erected and then toppled in recent years by anti-racist activists. Here's Joe again, reading from Castillo's book.
Sarah argued that he and his friars should be able to whip the Indians. They became recipients of severe punishment using whips, sharpened prods, shackles, and stocks if they did not commit to strict adherence to religious and community duties. There was a whipping post at the center of the mission.
The abuses that took place during the mission period happened all along the coast, including right here in Marin County. And this history is the backdrop to ranching on Point Reyes, because it was the Spanish mission at San Rafael and the friars who managed it who introduced cattle to the peninsula for the very first time in the early 1800s. The ranchers of today may not be directly descended from those first Spanish missionaries. In fact, many of them come from families that immigrated to the U.S. from other parts of Europe later in the century. Poor families trying to make a life in the New World. The dairies attracted immigrants from Switzerland, Italy, the Azores Islands, and other parts of Europe. Some of those same families run the ranches to this day. The Mendoza family, for instance, which supplies milk to Strauss Creamery, first came to Point Reyes from the Azores in 1899. They continue to operate today on historic Bee Ranch. When the Gold Rush brought thousands of new settlers to San Francisco, the dairy farms at Point Reyes grew into a thriving industry. But the practice of ranching on Point Reyes, and in many other places in California for that matter, can be traced directly to the violence and genocide of colonialism. As California became part of the United States, conditions for indigenous people only got worse. The mid-1800s, a time when the Point Reyes dairy industry was booming, was one of the darkest chapters yet for Native Americans. In California, private militias were formed to hunt and exterminate entire indigenous villages. These militias were then paid by the California government.
The monies they received for doing so was more than the money they would make doing their normal labor or whatever it was they were involved in.
Mm-hmm. So murder became a profitable industry.
Exactly. You could rape the mother, sell the children to slavery, kill the father, and collect a reward.
The public land that Point Reyes National Seashore sits on is the ancestral territory of the Coast Miwok. It is land that was taken by the Spanish, then claimed by ranchers. And it lies now in a state that publicly funded the extermination of Native peoples. But in the face of all this overwhelming violence, the Coast Miwok and indigenous peoples from many other tribes in California continue to survive.
While enduring much hardship at the hands of the invaders, our tribe, the Coast Miwok, have endured and still practice the ways and customs of our ancestors. We have survived and still practice those meaningful customs in our everyday lives.
However, many indigenous people lost access to their land. Some went to San Francisco to try and find work in the rapidly expanding city. But others returned to their ancestral lands on Tamalhuye and worked as fishermen or ranch hands, supporting the dairy operations which were in full swing. And, to bring things back full circle, the rise of ranching at Point Reyes happened at the same time the settlers were hunting the tule elk to near extinction.
Native people, our cosmologies and our epistemologies are about how we are related to the elk.
This is Teresa Harlan, who we heard at the beginning of the story. Teresa's adopted mother is Coast Miwok. Her ancestors are the original inhabitants of Point Reyes, and they have traditionally had a close relationship with the tule elk.
We're related to all animals, plants, and things, so these elk are our relatives. Me, as a Native person, I have to say that they are my relatives out there. And that's one of my concerns for the elk out here, is that they're brought here, and yet they cannot move about to have a healthy environment or foods, and they cannot live a sustainable life.
For Teresa, the elk represent her family's roots in this place, roots that continue to bring her back to Point Reyes. Her mother's family home is on Laird's Landing, or as she calls it, Felix Cove. I met Teresa at the park to visit her ancestral home. It's publicly accessible, but it's not a place tourists are likely to go. The path to the cove winds down from a grassy hilltop. As we walk, the landscape becomes greener. The trees grow taller, and the branches extend over our heads, enveloping us into the forest. The Coast Miwok may have walked this same path for centuries, or even millennia.
So all of this was occupied. Marshall Beach, Laird's Landing that we're calling Felix Cove, all of that. All of this whole area, just everywhere we've been today, you know.
Right.
The people have walked, lived their lives, hunted, fished, played, sang, mourned, shared meals, lived their lives. Mm-hmm. When I walked down this road, I always think about my mom. This is her little play yard, her walk to school, or walk home, or, you know, if they wanted to go out and do other things like berry picking, this is likely the road she took.
Teresa says her ancestors returned here in the early 1800s after surviving the displacement of the mission system.
So it goes way, way, way back before ranchers, sometime after Spanish missions. And so this is their home. Now we're getting under the trees. There's ferns are bigger, more flowers, and oak trees and bay trees. So if you look to your right, you're going to see the buildings.
Oh, there it is.
And so you see the house, and you see a little cabin behind the house, and now you can see the shed under the trees.
Tucked away under the oak and eucalyptus trees is a small house made from wooden planks with just two rooms and a front porch. Beyond the house is Tamales Bay. The waves gently lap against the shore, and you can see the town of Marshall across the bay where Teresa's mom was born.
Straight ahead of us is where my family would have had their bean and potato fields. And then my grandpa would till this area here and plant the vegetable garden, you know, tomatoes and string beans. And then he built a little barn that no longer exists in a little corral, and that's where the dairy cow.
Wow.
And they keep a hog once in a while for meat. And then there was chickens, ducks running around, chicken coops. So all of this that you see would have been tended. All of this would have been managed.
Today, the cove is overgrown and wild. The house is still standing, though the inside is dilapidated. There's graffiti written on one of the walls. A shed nearby is falling apart. Teresa reminisces about what life would have been like for her mom and grandparents here.
So what you would see is a porch steps that are not here. You would see a laundry line. You might find my grandmother sitting on the porch processing some vegetables from the garden, or maybe cleaning oysters. You would see the corral and the milk cow over here. You'd see my grandfather walking around, maybe repairing or fixing something. So the house would be filled with voices and people laughing and talking.
After surviving the mission system and the displacement and genocide of the 19th century, Teresa's family returned to live out their lives at the cove. But unfortunately, they would once more be forced off the land.
Well, my grandmother, Bertha, she died in 1949. And at the time, K Ranch was owned by Turney and Lundgren's. And shortly, a few years after my grandmother died, my uncle Vic, who lived here with my grandfather, they were served eviction papers.
Those eviction papers were served by Sales Turney and James Lundgren, two successful dairy farmers who claimed to own the land. Teresa's uncle, Victor Sousa, was the last Coast Miwok person to live on the 12-acre site of K Ranch, which included the land where Teresa's ancestors built their home. Victor brought the matter to court. If he could prove his family had lived on that property since the 1800s, he could make a successful squatter's rights claim to keep the land.
The ties to the family go back to the early 1800s. And so he had oral testimony at the time. The district attorney for Marin County, William Weissick, took the case as a pro bono case and represented my uncle, and he did a lot of research and collected oral testimony that our family lived here when San Francisco was known as Yerba Buena and a forest.
In fact, the Turney versus Sousa case was fought all the way up to the California Supreme Court. But the odds were stacked against Victor from the start.
So, unfortunately, oral testimony wasn't allowed and considered inadmissible. My uncle did not have a record of tax payments or tax records. And William Weissick was quoted as saying everyone in court knew the family lived there prior to the 1870s, but they could not meet the requirements of law, Western law, paper law. And I mean, this case of Native families losing land over lack of tax records is a common story all over the United States because everything came around them, yeah. You know. So people who've lived here continuously are not going to have deeds and tax records.
Victor Sousa lost the lawsuit and the cove. James Lundgren eventually sold the cove to a development group in 1969 and continued to ranch a few hundred acres on a different section of the land. The National Park Service bought Kay Ranch in 1972 and ironically evicted Lundgren's livestock off the property after what one historian called, quote, years of careless use of the rangeland.
It makes me sad when I think about how my uncle lost his court fight. It makes me sad about what we lost or what was taken from us. But it also makes me devoted to getting the attention needed so that this place isn't demolished, this place isn't vandalized. It has the same value as all the other treasured family homes, but it's not. It's been neglected since my family left.
Today, Kay Ranch, including Teresa's family homestead, is historically recognized by the Park Service and protected from new development. And the Park Service recently repaired the exterior of the house. But there's no signage indicating that it was a Coast Miwok home or how it was lost. And Teresa is fighting for her family's history to be part of the official narrative of the national park.
Yeah, this was home. So it is why I'm working so hard to try to get the park and everyone to hold it as dearly as I do and appreciate the historic significance of it as a Coast Miwok built structure. I would want to know this history. Where can I find this history? Right now, the history is being told by me and my family, by you and your story. The history, you cannot find it at the National Park Service website. You cannot find the story of how rich and diverse the family lived here.
National Park Service spokesperson Melanie Gunn says they have plans to highlight Teresa's family story as part of efforts to preserve Indigenous cultural history. She says the Park Service is actively talking with Teresa's family and that the park is also required to consult with the Federated Indians of Graton Rancheria in the management of these parklands.
That's an active development. We're in kind of in communication with the tribe. So this is kind of when we go back to saying, okay, look, we have these historic buildings and this story to tell. We collaborate with the tribe on how do we want to tell this story.
The Park Service has a government-to-government relationship with the Federated Indians of Graton Rancheria, a federally recognized tribe of Coast Miwok and Pomo people. Teresa Harlan and Joe Sanchez, who we heard from earlier, are not members of this tribe.
There was a very specific decision made by the park's archaeologist and cultural resources lead that those buildings, the Teresa Harlan's family buildings, are really significant because of the overlapping time of when they were occupied by Coast Miwok, kind of in the beginning of Spanish ranching and then once it became a state and that transition. So we want to tell that story and we'll work with the tribe to do that in the best way possible.
I'm going to repeat that because I think it's important. A National Park Service spokesperson just acknowledged that the site was occupied by Coast Miwok through the transition from Spanish missions to ranching. That acknowledgement comes 70 years after Teresa's family lost this land, when the California Supreme Court upheld their eviction. Today, the fight over Point Reyes continues. Ranchers, environmentalists, activists, indigenous groups, and the National Park Service continue to debate the future of this land and who gets to control its use. While ranching is set to continue for the foreseeable future, indigenous communities are still advocating for a larger role in deciding the use of the land. The Park Service has formed an agreement with the Federated Indians of Greaten Rancheria. But Coast Miwok Tribal Council of Marin members like Joe Sanchez, who are not part of Greaten Rancheria, say they will continue to be left out of that process. When I began reporting this story, I wanted to find out who gets to control the land at Point Reyes, who gets to profit, and at what cost does that profit come to the environment. This story started with the Tule Elk, but it's about so much more than that. At its core, the story of Point Reyes is about how the forces of colonialism and the violence of indigenous displacement continue to shape the state of California today, 500 years after settlers came to this land for the first time. It's also about who gets to control the narrative of that history. Wherever there is a fight over the use of public land in this country, that fight has its roots in colonialism. Because before public land became public, there were people who lived on this land. Even after the horrors of genocide and displacement, indigenous peoples are still here, fighting for the chance to shape the future of the same land that was taken from them generations ago. Reporting from Point Reyes for KPFA, I'm Sam Anderson. This story was edited by Lucy Kang as part of the KPFA Storytelling Project.